Just after the emergency all hands, staff is frustrated and disillusioned by management's intransigence. For hours, workers passionately spoke out against management's decision to cancel the comic book project, Always Punch Nazis. And management had not moved an inch from their original stance. In part three of the oral history, we'll hear how management's response to collective action galvanized workers and mobilized the union's first organizers. We're picking up just after the word union was spoken for the first time within the walls of Kickstarter. Staff is upset, Taylor just yelled union at Brian in the bike room, and many folks have left the office drained and angry. Angry at how Perry's new senior leadership team handled their first crisis.
So I was the office light. Most people had left. We were going to play D&D in the library later. So we went up there and I walked down the hallway and I passed one of the big meeting rooms in the hallway. This is like 8:30 or 9 o'clock that night. And I see the entire senior team, all the management is sitting in this room. And in the middle of the table, they got the speakerphone set up. They're having some kind of conference call. And every single one of them looks like they are sweating bullets. They look like they have seen a ghost and the ghost is now yelling at them, telling them they did a bad job. And later I would learn is that they were conferencing Perry and they were briefing Perry on what had been going on.
In many ways, the story of Always Punch Nazis is really the story of how was SOT formed, because it really revealed, it forcibly revealed what that structure was.
The next day, the VP of Community Strategy sends a memo out to the entire company stating that leadership had reversed their decision. They would not suspend the project, but would go back to the original decision of the Trust and Safety team and allow the comic to continue funding on Kickstarter.
And we thought we had won. I mean, we thought, holy shit, this is great. Like, yes, having to convince them to do this sucked, but they listened. And we did the right thing. Like we as a company did the right thing. We can be proud to work here, right? The list of companies that capitulated to like the resurgent rise of the neo-Nazis in the early 21st century is not going to include Kickstarter. We can say that as small as it was, when our time came and the spotlight was on us, we did the right thing, right? That's great. That feels good. And these new management people, these new leaders, they'll listen. Like, they'll fight you, but they will do the right thing. And that also felt great because it was their first crisis. And so now we felt, well, we might disagree, but we can trust them, right? They're like us. They'll listen and they're willing to think through this stuff. So we, like, I remember the feeling after that email went out was, I mean, it was almost euphoric. I mean, everything was clicking. It was like, oh man, this could work. Like, we're not alone here. We did the right thing.
And then, a week after the emergency all hands, Trust and Safety gathers for their weekly team meeting. Immediately, they sense that something's off. Kickstarter's new general counsel, the same person who had led the emergency all hands, was about to kick off a calculated mass retaliation effort across the company, starting with the team that blew the whistle.
There was one seat at the head of the table that was empty. I walk in, try to sit at it, and was like, no, is going to sit there. And so I got up and walked to a different chair, not even kidding.
The general counsel walks in, sits down at the head of the table, looks at the analysts across from him, significantly raises his voice and launches into a prepared statement.
The way he yelled at people so far below him. I mean, this is our general counsel coming to the lowest level employees at the company and yelling. It was so unprofessional, so unleader-like. It was horrible. It was horrible. He raised his voice and said, I'm deeply disappointed in the way your team acted last week.
Deeply disappointed in how our team acted last week. This is not a discussion. Huge difference between personal politics and company politics. And if you can't separate the two, you should find a new job. We do not operate by consensus. There's a decision-making process. We may disagree. You will respect the decision-making framework. We are in a unique position, have access to a lot of sensitive information. Don't want to have these convos going forward. Hope we can maintain a level of professionalism seen prior to last week. And then left, got up promptly, left.
The director of trust and safety looks around the room at the analysts, his direct reports.
In like a sort of sotto voce, he said, I agree with Chris on all these points, but he said he had faith that we can write this, come out stronger. And he wanted to hold one-on-ones with us. He wants folks to sit with it. He left the room and the analysts were just left there. And it was silent. It was silent. It was silent. And then the words started coming out. And I remember a couple of people, one person definitely cried. And I remember she said, I love this company. And I just can't believe like we can't stand up for what is actually right. And like the one time that I stand up for what I think is actually right, I get punished for it. I see so much bad stuff. And the one time that I say that like us taking down this project is bad, you know, people like come after me for it, essentially. And I remember she cried. And that was hard to watch. It's really, really hard to watch.
I think the feeling was shock, despair. These are pretty strong words, but grief. Honestly, though, it was a very difficult meeting. The folks on the trust and safety team have always been very thoughtful about the work that they do, very empathetic. The reasons why we were where we were not, you know, it was not the fault of the individual employees. It was the fault of folks that were not traditionally inside that room. And so now the idea that we were in a meeting where a lot of my colleagues were hurt very deeply was very difficult to watch.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing that I said was that was abusive, like that was toxic. This was horrible, the way he treated us. This was extremely uncalled for. This should not be acceptable. I had the opportunity to come into that room and say, hey, last week did not go as any of us had planned. Like, what are some ways that you all think that we could do better? Or he could have said, here are some ways that I think we could have done better. Or what do you, like, it's so many different ways that he could have approached this, but coming in and yelling, I'm trembling even thinking about it because he threatened our jobs. It was very clear that if you don't sit down and shut up and stay in line, you get the fuck out.
We are only able to do our jobs when we can communicate openly about how and why decisions are getting made. So this was like not out of, this is not out of the purview of how we normally operated, though we were told that, you know, we had fucked up.
It was all very calculated. Everyone on TNS was taken into like a specific one-on-one with our director. He wanted to like suss out our feelings afterwards.
And I remember in this conversation asking him, you know, how he accounted for cherishing diverse perspectives in nuanced conversations like this, and how he expected folks of diverse perspectives to feel like they could continue participating in these conversations when he and another white man were going to bat for Nazis. And he was not too pleased about that.
After the very difficult meeting between the general counsel and the trust and safety team, management encouraged staff to come to them individually if they had any follow-up questions or concerns. But when members of the team used this direct line to management to speak up about how they had been treated, or voice concern about retaliation, it becomes clear that these feedback channels are not safe.
I was very anxious because I felt that they were going to fire Justine. Honestly, I felt extremely guilty that she was being treated like that by leadership because I had reached out to Amy and Robert to kick this off, you know, so I felt personally responsible, and I reached out to my director and my boss and wrote them a Slack message. It was like a long paragraph that said, hey, I appreciate you taking the time to read this. Like, I'm really concerned about the way that spoke to us. I really hope that our team can like rebuild and heal from this. Like, I think there's a lot of growth that we can learn from this, but express that I like was concerned, you know, I was concerned about Justine. And I wrote that message in hopes to, I don't know, like shed some light on how we were feeling as a team. Like they, the way they were treating us was really, it was so mean the way they were speaking to us. And the emails that we had been receiving were horrible. It's just horrible. So I tried to express that in a Slack message. And I also felt that they respected me as an employee. I felt that they would receive this positively. I really did.
Sarah followed the direction of management and shared a concern about how the general counsel had reprimanded the trust and safety team. And in this Slack message, she expressed concern about retaliation against a fellow team member. Immediately, Sarah is pulled into a meeting with her manager, the new head of trust and safety, and the head of HR. This meeting is not to address her concerns or for management to better understand the behavior of the general counsel. This meeting is to formally discipline Sarah for speaking up. When listening to the audio from this disciplinary meeting, it's clear management's main goal is not to protect the employee or the health of the team. It's to identify employees who might question decisions or management behavior in the future and silence them. And this would become a central tactic in management's future anti-union strategy. Here is the director of trust and safety and the head of HR speaking to Sarah just hours after she reported the general counsel's inappropriate behavior.
Honestly, like really just trying to be helpful in communicating that to you today. I've been told last week to like talk to your managers and your direct leadership about like concerns or expressing issues that you might have. And so like, I actually thought I was doing the right thing by messaging you and communicating that. And like, it clearly was like not like received that way. And so I guess I just want to know like what the right way or the way that you all prefer me to communicate those concerns with you, because like we should be on the same page about just like communicating like healthy, you know, like for the betterment of our like team. And so what is the best way for me to like raise concerns to you about that? Managers the way that I was told to do. I just like, you know, I'm just trying to like figure out what would like what's your preferred approach. Like I want to be as helpful as possible, you know.
Maybe not the whether it be the tone or whatever it was from that conversation, but like the content in the email.
Sure.
I wanted to make sure that you're aligned with that, because I think without that, there's more root issue.
Yes, that was our biggest takeaway, is that what you expressed in your message this morning was at odds with the expectations that Chris and myself outlined.
Now something very interesting happens. A theme that would come up again and again in union-related retaliation is an accusation that, by questioning management or reporting an issue, a worker was undermining their direct manager and creating an environment where the manager was unable to function in their role. This idea of worker feedback being a kind of punishable insubordination will come up again and again as a key tactic in management's anti-union strategy.
In order for to succeed in their jobs, it's leading the team in the way they see best fit to do that. You know what I mean? And I think it's going to be slightly different. So I just want to make sure there's not a misalignment. Like, I know other people have said that I signed up for a different type of role. And I think the role is different now. So that's why I totally support saying that if the role has changed and it's not something that you're excited about or happy with, it's okay to have that conversation. So I figured this would be a good opportunity for that.
What did you feel like you could do? Like, I don't want to put someone in a position where they're having to make decisions that they just can't live with. Beyond, like, the work and the workflows and things like that, I think I would want to hear, and I know we're almost out of time here, but, like, you personally, as a person, I know you're very passionate. You're very, just that you stand up for what you believe in.
Totally.
I think that's fantastic. But there's going to be situations like this one that are going to go against those feelings that you have.
By the end of this disciplinary meeting, a meeting that was prompted by an employee expressing concern about the treatment of herself and her team members, the head of HR makes it clear that directly communicating anything other than agreement with management will lead you to the door. They've backed her into a corner, and she now has to apologize for reporting inappropriate behavior from senior management.
Yeah, I want to apologize if this was came across wrong today. Like, my goal really is just to strengthen our team and to help our team, because I really just didn't want to risk anything deterring us from long-term vision.
One-on-one conversations were part of management's strategy to identify and stamp out any lingering dissent in the trust and safety team and across the company. But for Justine, the team member who commented in Slack, making the larger company aware of management's decision, far harsher retaliation was around the corner. Sarah was right. The new head of HR and the new director of trust and safety took Justine into the room with no windows, sat her down, and told her she could no longer be trusted.
We, in the rest of the company, especially the outreach team, need to know when a decision has been reached in these cases where the trust and safety team is deciding on the outcomes of canceling or not canceling a project. That is a common sense thing. We need that information. She gave us that information, and she was now being fired because of it. And they said, we do not trust you. We do not think we can work with you or trust you in the future. You might want to consider resigning. And they gave her a letter of resignation and a deal, a termination package that they would promise her if she resigned. And they put that on the table and she took the deal. Now, legally, in some aspects, that is not a firing because she volunteered to sign and leave the company. What it is constructive termination. Right? It is a clever way to fire someone without it technically legally being an exact firing. But absolutely, this constructive termination was in effect in all ways a firing.
I could have very easily also been that person. If you've ever gotten the chance to work with Justine, you know how amazing she is at her job. She is an internet sleuth by nature, but also so detailed in her work. She's an incredible human being. I feel very lucky to have worked with her.
And not only is Justine an amazing person and such an asset for like any company, but she also was very good at her job. Like she gave a fuck. Like I swear, like in like the analysis that she would provide about like different projects and things, like she was just a really good employee. She was a great integrity analyst. If Kickstarter was like this capitalist place that like wanted people who were good at their jobs, then they would have kept her for that reason.
After management came down on the trust and safety team and fired the visible whistleblower, they began to divide up the company and identify outspoken members of the collective action that threatened their authority. Brian, the worker who had threatened to quit in the emergency all hands, was pulled into a one-on-one with the VP of engineering.
He chastised me for my brinksmanship, which was in reference, you know, to me threatening to quit.
And this happened over and over across every team at the company in different but coordinated forms.
I was brought into a meeting with my manager where it was basically like we talked about how I had acted during the incident. Basically, all I had said was, this is a great time for Kickstarter to act with moral clarity. That's like verbatim all I said. Like the effect of that meeting was like, basically don't speak up. Yeah, basically just don't rock the boat.
And he says something to the effect of, your behavior during the library meeting was inappropriate. And I go, excuse me? Like, I was not at the library meeting. I did not attend that meeting. And he goes sort of like, oh, okay. Well, just your whole behavior was inappropriate. And you didn't leave space for, like, other people's opinions who thought the project should be taken down. And I go like, okay, tell me when and where you have evidence for that. Because I did no such thing, you know, in any public setting, no such thing. which like, you know, the term gaslighting has usually a really negative connotation because generally it's in the direction of someone who is powerful doing it to someone who is less powerful. In this case, I think it's kind of funny because it's like, was absolutely right that I was involved in this situation. But he had absolutely zero evidence to back that up. And so I really could just throw it back on him and be like, what are you talking about? I don't know what you mean. After sort of digging in, you know, he sort of said a few kind of like dodgy things or like whatever. And I kind of just kept asking the same question, kept just like kind of poking at it a little bit and eventually get him to admit that had Googled me and had found that I had radical politics and wanted to make sure that I was okay working at a place that had different political views than my own.
Kickstarter's general counsel identified workers believed to have had a hand in standing up to management and forcing leadership to reverse the decision. And then he researched them, and then he directed management to discipline them, whether there was evidence of their involvement or not. It was an incredibly wide net.
Our manager sent our team an email calling us toxic. And in a face-to-face meeting in the office, made it very clear that we were not to question management's decisions again. And this is just a job. We don't need to care about that sort of stuff. And we should just be quiet and do our job. And, you know, reiterated that our behavior speaking out at the meeting had been toxic. Toxic, mind you.
Yeah, I was like just sort of thrown off for like the next week. I was just kind of like, man, did I do something wrong? Like, was I, you know, taking up too much space? Was I like being too loud? Was I being an asshole unintentionally? I tend to, you know, if someone gives me criticism like that, I'm usually going to take it and like honestly examine it. But yeah, that like made me feel just really kind of alone and shitty for the next week until I started talking to other people at work who had also been brought into one-on-one meetings like that. And they kind of said it went down the same way for them. And then I started thinking, well, wait, hold on. I'm not wrong here. We were all saying good things. We were trying to get Kickstarter to make the right choice here.
When we spoke out against their decision, and then when Perry told them that they better not do anything stupid and they better do what the staff says, they're invalid. So they had been invalidated from below, and then they were invalidated from the top. And that cannot stand. If we speak up against them, and then the boss comes down and says no, well, then they're crushed. And so you have this little like compressed pocket of middle management that is now extremely angry, but they can't show that they're angry, right? Because that would reveal that would let the cat out of the bag. That would be the reveal of the whole game, right? They can't let us see them sweat. So that they now have to use work language and work levers to exact their revenge. So they called us toxic. They said we should never do that again, even though no one was harmed. And by their own admission, like you said, they ended up making the right decision.
After this week of retaliation, a handful of engineers make their way around the corner to a bar that looks across the East River. And one by one, they start to share that they had been individually reprimanded by management.
So the four of us were talking, and as Brian explained his story of being reprimanded, he and Patrick noted that other folks that they knew on the engineering team who had also spoken up were also reprimanded.
I was like, oh, me too. I was aware that like many people were receiving this feedback and also kind of bizarrely, similarly formatted feedback. But these other engineers were like not aware of that. They were like more isolated. And so they're like, oh, I was feeling really bad about what I had done. I felt like I had messed up and I wasn't sure why. Like I didn't understand what I had done wrong, but I guess like I must have messed up or made people uncomfortable or whatever. And I was like, I'm so glad we're having this conversation because like you didn't, like you did great. You know, you stood up for what you believe in. Like, you know, like everyone is receiving this feedback. It's like totally bullshit. Like, don't take it personally. And then I think that conversation was where me and Sarah decided to try and organize what we called the like unofficial debrief.
The workers who a week earlier had set the collective action in motion put together a small gathering to process this wave of retaliation from leadership.
There needs to be a debrief of this. Management is not going to do one, so let's just do one ourselves.
And in this small gathering, workers start to put together the full extent of management's retaliation.
Okay, let's all just understand more sides of like how this went down and kind of our shared experience to help us kind of move past it.
It was mind-boggling. I knew that our team had gotten it bad, but then seeing engineers who were just yelled at for asking a question during the library meeting was ridiculous. It's just like, what do you mean they can't ask a question? What do you mean they got pulled aside by their manager and yelled at? Like, what?
And this is the first time many of us heard about what the general counsel had done to our coworkers in the trust and safety team.
I just remember feeling so sad and disappointed and hurt. I already understood this devaluing of non-engineers at the company. And to hear that he felt like, because he didn't come do that to me, you know, he was upset at me. He didn't do that to me. But to feel like he had the right to go into that room with the employees that were just doing their job. And like, you know, it needs to be said that the people on these team were, you know, mostly women, people of color, trans, queer. You know, he felt that he had power over them in some way, that he could yell at them like that. And I don't think he would have felt comfortable going to a team full of engineers and doing the same thing. And that's, yeah, it was infuriating. And I wanted to do what I could to make sure no one had to go through that again.
It was a really powerful moment to see the commonality between people's experiences of censorship and retaliation. I think that it's really easy at work to feel isolated and like my relationship with my manager is individual. And, you know, if I have a problem, it's because of my manager, it's because of me, and not, oh, this is reflective of a problem with the overall culture of the company. And in that moment, it felt like the first moment of kind of like pulling the rug back and seeing all of the retaliation and kind of individual moments of conflict that had been swept under the rug. It felt like a moment where we got to start piecing together that this was not like an individual problem. This was a collective grievance and a collective issue embedded in Kickstarter's culture and how Kickstarter's leadership abuses power in order to control its employees.
Then we started to talk about how there was no process in place for holding leadership accountable or for protecting staff against retaliation. The head of HR, who was working with the general counsel to carry out this widespread coordinated retaliation, had never built trust with staff.
Absolutely. I mean, the number of times that I tried to work with our broken HR team about anything is just countless and astounding. And I remember specifically, as soon as the regime change happened, as soon as we had new leadership on the HR team, one of the first things that they did was kind of remove the reporting tool that we were using for any kind of offense, for workplace disputes amongst equals, for sexual harassment claims, for issues of pay or retaliation or anything that HR is responsible for. They took away that avenue for us to be able to anonymously report injustices, even on a more mundane level, just to ask questions about the direction of the organization or about that team in general. They took that away from us. After a significant stretch of months had elapsed between them saying, it's our number one priority to replace a tool like this because we understand the importance of being safe in the workplace, and a complete lack of communication around how and when they intended to address that issue, I sent an email saying, hey, just want to follow up on this. We currently are living in a world where there's no way for us to anonymously and safely report things that are happening to us every day that are largely being caused by, at worst and at best, neglected by your team. And, I mean, the response that we got to that email, I think that you maybe even chimed into that email. I think that we both responded to reaction.
Yeah.
But, the response was completely vapid and empty of any substance. And we're working on it. And this is when we really started. This is when I started seeing language that was just kind of explicitly totalitarian and anti-union, even before we got to unionization as a concept. I mean, the fact that this person would try to justify to me taking away channels that made me feel I could safely exist and operate in this space as a queer person, as a person of color, as someone who is fairly young and new to the workforce was, just astounding.
Someone or another was like, oh, well, HR is so useless. And someone else was said something like, well, what if we ran HR? What if we had a people's HR? And that's when I remember M. Stu saying, oh, a people's HR, that's called a union. Maybe what we need is a union. And that was actually the first place where I heard someone mention the idea of a union.
This small employee huddle happened to be in the room with no windows inside the walls of Kickstarter. And this huddle is where we see the union begin to take shape. Employees came together, shared experiences, concerns, frustrations, and they started to brainstorm possible solutions to these issues that could protect workers from management. And this was happening in different ways all across the company.
Kind of in parallel to me setting up this debrief, Taylor was doing these one-on-ones where he was just explicitly attempting to start union organizing.
I really genuinely wasn't sure that these conversations were going to lead to a union. I was open, if there was a better option, if there was a better solution, I was open to it. I didn't know enough to be sure about a union at first, but I knew these conversations had to happen.
Before workers could catch our breath, something else happens. Leadership is about to make another decision detrimental to the company, the community, and to staff's faith in management. At this point, Kickstarter is a crucible. Staff is worn down by the chaotic leadership decisions. We've said goodbye to far too many coworkers, and we've started to get a sense that management is becoming more and more adversarial. The internal turmoil within the walls of Kickstarter is making it harder and harder for staff to focus on work. And we're just weeks away from the planned launch of Drip, one of our most promising platform expansions. Drip had been in beta for quite a while as the team onboarded creators so that the engineering team could work out bugs and the platform could launch with strong content. Just 2 weeks before Drip is slated to go live, leadership announces that Kickstarter is ending the development of Drip, that there will be no public release, and that they are trying to find a way to give Drip a new home to another company outside of Kickstarter.
I ran into the office for the end of the workday to listen to Perry at an all hands say to the whole organization that Drip just wasn't working and kind of needed more care and attention. This coming from the primary person who was neglecting said product and had been since the jump. That was also the first time that I really had the visibility and access to leadership that proved to me that these are not people who have some kind of secret merits or people who are so far and beyond my capacity or ability to understand this product or the people that use it. These are just people who, you know, due to their circumstance and largely their privilege, have ended up in positions of power and are doing everything they can to hold on to them. And that was a really eye-opening moment for me, I think, as someone who is really optimistic by nature and had really been seeing the entirety of the organization through rose-colored glasses since day one. As soon as Perry came back and undid all of the work that I had spent the past year doing for that product, I realized, okay, there is a large systemic issue at play at Kickstarter.
Now management was not only threatening the moral compass of Kickstarter and the security of workers. Now they were jeopardizing our ability to serve the community and stay competitive. And it was about to get worse. Not long after Drip had been handed off to a team outside of Kickstarter, leadership announces that even that team would not be launching and maintaining the platform. Drip was dead.
It was heartbreaking to get that announcement and to know that the years of work that we put into that prior, seemingly overnight, was destroyed. It was really hard.
There are still these blockbuster projects that just like generate so much money for Kickstarter. And we were living off of that for like 4 to 5 years. We could have afforded to like redirected resources to a new project like Drip and not just cut it.
So much of the reason why I wanted to do this work was to have these two different options for how to counsel people about fundraising. And it really felt like losing Drip was going to reduce my arsenal.
The unfortunate truth about Drip and the way that Drip was handled is it was pitched to us as essentially the thing that was going to make the product better. Perry came back and he kind of stood up at all hands and he said, "Here I am to lead you into the future. We are at a point where the product has not changed in years. We have the one core product offering and it's time to expand the mission. And Drip is our best hope of doing that." But it's a product that was immediately neglected by leadership. And looking back, it's clear to see that they never actually cared about the product. It was used as a vehicle to be able to have this regime change that put him back at the top of the organization as CEO, majority shareholder, chairman of the board. It was a tight fist.
This is when the spark becomes a flame. The employees of Kickstarter had weathered a contentious leadership change. We'd watched a mass exodus as workers and management fled Perry's new regime. We navigated an inoperable organizational structure while sprinting to hit unreasonable deadlines. We'd seen management make unethical decisions, and then we experienced acute retaliation for standing up to those decisions. And now, years of work and significant investment in Drip was recklessly washed away. This was a moment of clarity. Leadership had continually failed to support the community Kickstarter served. We needed a way to safeguard Kickstarter itself. Workers needed a seat at the table.
All these problems, everything that Perry has done since he's come back, and the big problems that we faced before Perry came back. All those problems have the same root. All the power, it's concentrated in just a few people. That is the key problem, is that there is a bottleneck of agency. There's only one person, Perry Chinn, that gets to make decisions that affect everybody else. And what we have seen in the last year is that he makes very bad decisions. And with the Always Punch Nazis project and the way management retaliated afterwards, we can see that both Perry and management are not making just bad decisions, but aggressively malicious decisions in revenge. And not revenge against people that deserve it. Revenge against people that did nothing but want us to not help Nazis. The only way to fix all these problems is to change the nature of that power, right? And the only way, well, the most obvious way, right? Let's say that. The only way that is clearly built for this is for us, the group, the people that actually work here and do the work and provide the value. If we come together and demand to have some of that power for ourselves, not to take over the company, but just to act as a check and a balance against all the power right now being concentrated in just one person.
Cue Kickstarter United. You know, here we go.
At this point, staff had experienced a plethora of challenges that are systemic across tech. Pay inequity, retaliation, costly product decisions. It was clear the power imbalance was hurting the employees and the community we served. We knew that a union is a group of workers committed to each other. Now we just needed to figure out how to build one.
I don't know if the union's right. Neither of us knows if a union is right, but it's definitely the only solution that we know of right now. Let's start talking. Let's talk about other people that might agree with us on this, that might feel the same way. And that list of names was long, let me tell you.
Sarah told me that some folks were meeting and asked me if I wanted to come. And, you know, she was vague. She didn't say the U word. But she said that it was kind of a continuation based off of the original conversation we had had about retaliation.
After Always Punch Nazis, I was approached by one of my friends in the workplace asking if I wanted to like go get a coffee with her and just talk about what happened. And it didn't go in a unionizing direction. It was more of like, hey, we're thinking about meeting outside of the workplace and we're going to talk about what we can do regarding the situation, and maybe we'll like write a letter as a show of solidarity. Would you be interested in that? And I was like, yeah, sure. Why not?
I mean, it felt really cool to do something secret always. So it was like, we all want this thing. We're all in this room talking about it. Like, it felt very like secret society-ish or something. Like, it was very, it felt cool. That sort of like energy around starting something new and exciting that people are like, that can really make a huge difference is like just so cool. Even in the early meetings, we had like a pretty significant number of people come to the meetings, especially considering the size of the company, right? So in the initial meeting, we had like 10 or 12 people or something like that. The whole company is like 160, 170 people, right? So it's like already we had like a significant percentage of the company in the room.
This after work meeting we were having felt more like a way to kind of vent frustrations in the workplace and talk about like the events that were unfolding. And it felt like the union word was thrown around occasionally, but it didn't feel that serious at the time. It was more of just like a space for us to vocalize how we felt about the way management was running the company.
In these meetings, the idea of a union quickly became a central topic. And workers, sometimes in groups and sometimes on their own, were researching this tool that most of us had little to no experience with.
So I knew that there were not really any unions in the tech industry at the time. And I had never worked a union job in my life.
I just knew that it was a way, it was kind of like a way for workers to have a voice at work, basically.
I had done some kind of general leftist political organizing, and I had some friends that had done labor organizing. And so I was sort of like aware of the idea, definitely like knew that, you know, in amongst the my beliefs and people that believed what I, you know, the things that I believe about the world, like unions were good and that we wanted them. So definitely was like, you know, very pro-union, knew that that was something that would be awesome, but it had sort of always felt like it was like out of reach.
People in our generation just don't know anything about unions because so few of us are in them. And the history is certainly not taught in school. Heaven forbid that, you know, our society should educate children about the one of the most important ways to create and balance the benefits and resources that society provides for normal people. Heaven forbid. So most people just don't know about any of this. I had no clue. I had no, but I did know this. I did know that it was power.
We set out to learn from everyone we could. Friends, books, archives, family members.
When I grew up, my parents were both in unions. So my dad was an airline pilot, so he was part of ALPA. My mom was a elementary school teacher, and she's part of the California Teachers Union. And I had grandparents who were in like UFCW, and my other grandpa was in like the firefighters union. So it's union's not really much of a like complex thing in my family. It was just like something I grew up with and something I was familiar with. So I didn't really know how much stigma there was around them, kind of, until like the union drive. It was just like, oh yeah, my dad is going to stay home from work today because United Airlines is doing something bad. Like, okay, that makes sense. And I didn't realize that they were so political and like, I don't know. Going into tech, I didn't really give it much thought, like, oh, unions aren't here, but maybe that's fine. And then it wasn't until like a few years in tech where it's like, wow, we really need unions.
In Spanish, the word union is sindicato. And so my experience with the word union is sindicato de obreros. So like a worker's syndicate almost is the direct translation. I've seen people strike. And I think the most times that I've ever seen people strike were for like better working conditions and stuff like that. I remember organized like groups of people doing strikes without necessarily having a union behind them. And then I also remember people being fired for things like that. I experienced these all these things as a child, right? Like, or as a teenager. So when the nationwide group of teachers would strike, like that just means that like that would affect personally like my classes and stuff like that. And so similarly, when the mining industry workers would strike, that would mean that like because I lived in a town that was dedicated to like a mining company, it basically would mean that they would close roads and blockade and like actually like march and strike. So yeah, it's kind of a crash course in collective action in some ways. It was definitely like, wow, like groups of people can achieve something if they all are in agreement and are setting their minds to it.
Some of our coworkers had real-world experience with unions. They had seen firsthand how these human institutions functioned.
So I was in a union once before, although I was not involved in organizing it. I worked at the Strand Bookstore, which is perhaps an unlikely place to have had my union education. But the Strand is in the Auto Workers Union, if memory serves. And we did go on strike once while I was there, when contract negotiations broke down, and we did a little walkout, and I think we picketed, and it was this like, you know, a small group of like young hipster bookstore workers surrounded by a lot of like burly auto workers who came to, you know, lend support and help us out and make the demonstration more dramatic.
I used to work at a union when I was in high school. Yeah, I worked at a union in Bay Ridge, Brooklyn, for about three to four years, I think. I was just like aware of like the benefits of the union in the classic sense of like, oh, we got a bunch of people who didn't have access to healthcare before, we got them access to healthcare. You know, coming from my background and knowing my experience and like what I, you know, what I had seen and witnessed, if we're going to do this, I want to make sure that we do it right.
So I'm a longtime organizer. I've been doing community organizing for about 10 years. And the past few years of my life before joining Kickstarter were really focused on sharing resources and knowledge among community organizers around the globe and then locally, which included union organizers who have been doing everything from traditional labor organizing, like with SEIU, or some of the newer organizing that's happening, for example, with United for Respect, that's organizing Walmart workers in really interesting and decentralized ways.
In these early days, while we were researching and starting to form a working collective, quite a few of the organizers thought that management might be open to the idea of a union.
I remember distinct conversations between like me and Taylor and you know, like the first union meeting that we all had, being like, oh, this is gonna be no problem. It's gonna be easy. Yeah, we thought it was gonna be super easy.
That was a bit naive. Perry would later go on to fight the union tooth and nail.
Next in the oral history of Kickstarter's union, we'll get an inside look at what happens when management becomes aware of organizing and how they react.
We had a mole.
We have become aware that some kind of collective action or possibly a union effort has been going on at the company, and we know that people in this room are involved.
The Kickstarter Union Oral History is brought to you by the Engelberg Center on Innovation Law and Policy at NYU Law. It's released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 4.0 international license. And the music was composed by Michael Simonelli over at the podcast production company Charts and Leisure. Thanks, guys.